The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. Microphone is on, I see. Well, welcome to the panel on the awarding of governmental national security contracts. The diversity of our panel reflects that the topic of national security contracts cuts a very wide swath. Our panel members are Terry Marlowe, who is the Vice President for Acquisition Policy at the Aerospace Corporation. The Aerospace Corporation provides independent scientific research and development and other related assistance to the space programs of the United States Air Force, the National Reconnaissance Organization, and agencies such as NASA and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency. Larry Halloran is Staff Director for the Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging National Threats, and International Relations. The committee falls under the aegis of the Committee on Government Reform. Scott Amey is the General Counsel of the Project on Government Oversight. It's a nonprofit organization whose purpose is to investigate and expose federal government corruption and other misconduct. I'm sort of a trifecta. I currently practice government contract law at the firm of Dykema Gossett. In the 34 years before I started there, 11 years ago, I was a government servant. I spent a little bit of time as a government contracting officer. I actually have a warrant to be a contracting officer, and then many years as a attorney advisor all the way up to general counsel in agencies dealing with government contracts. And for the last 11 years, I've also been teaching the course in government contract law here at the Washington College of Law. Our federal procurement system is largely and historically a creature of legislation. It stems from constitutional separation of powers. The Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution provides that the executive agencies will not spend money unless money has been appropriated to them by Congress. And when Congress appropriates money, it certainly has the authority to set rules on how that money will be spent. The effect of military operations, and particularly in combat situations, has had a deep effect on the evolution of our procurement system, particularly the conflicts of the Civil War, World War I, and World War II. There are a number of reasons for this, some of them self-evident, like you need to convert industrial plants from making luxury automobiles into tanks or other ground vehicles. That's one reason. The other is that in order for combatants to get an edge, they pursue advances in technology. And the acquisition of high technology, advanced technology, even in the Civil War, where putting armor on floating craft was pushing the envelope of the technological base at those times, that kind of puts some pressure on our traditional system of acquisition, which emphasizes free, open, and full competition. So we'll explore how those pressures on the values of our procurement system are operating in more current times as we go through the panel discussions. I trust you'll find that the presentations will address and hopefully pique your interest in topics that you've come to hear about. And I would encourage, we are certainly going to leave time for a question and answer session, for you use that time to develop further items that you've heard discussed and might want to hear discussed further, or if we haven't covered something that's within your frame of interest, that's the time to raise it. We'll begin our program with Mr. Marlowe. He is going to take us through a view of the procurement system as it currently exists, how it might be affected by certain changes, whether or not style reform, what are the costs and benefits, and then sort of a look over the horizon at what the future might bring. Kerry?
Thanks, Bill, and good afternoon, everyone. Nice to see all of you. Can I just, I want to have a little bit of audience participation here since it's right after lunch. I'd like to know how many of you are students here. As, could you raise your hands just to kind of see? And then how many people here are in the contracting, maybe federal contracting community? One, two. Oh, good. Okay, great. Maybe we'll have some questions about it. I think we have time for a joke, don't we? I mean, it is right after lunch. This story was told to me by one of my old bosses. He was giving a talk much like this one, and he told this story. And he was at the University of Southern California, and there was a professor there who was very highly revered by all the students because he took a real interest in the students, and he gave lots of good advice, and they all hung on every word, and they would write down what he said and kind of keep a record of it and everything. And so everybody vied to get in this class, and as luck would have it, Mike got in this class, and sure enough, he really liked the professor. He gave all this really great advice, and a week or so went by, and he went into class one day, and the professor was giving out some more advice, and it was about success. And he said, you know, students, he said, I think you ought to, you should think about the thing that you want to be, because the thing that you think about the most and focus on is going to be the thing that you become one day. And so he wrote it down. He was walking across campus later and thinking about what the professor said. And he said, you know, this guy's giving me a lot of good advice, but I'm not sure about this piece of advice. He said, you know, if I were to actually become what I think about the most, I'd already be a girl. So anyway, I'm going to try to give you some things to think about that give you a little bit of perspective on acquisition. I know sometimes, you kind of get your perspective from what you read in the paper, and so it's kind of nice to have an opportunity like this to come and talk to you. Bill and I, you can see what great buddies we are and how much we know each other. I'm actually from the Aerospace Industries Association. It's a trade association. What I'm going to be talking about today here really are my thoughts. I'm not really here representing the trade association, although I'm sure some of what I'm going to have to say is consistent with what they have to think. Let me get back to the audience participation a little bit. Let me just ask you how many of you out there think, based on what you know about it, think the federal acquisition process is broken. Anybody? Yeah. Two? God, I thought this was a lawyers. I thought you guys were all critical of everything. I thought you'd be critical of this. Okay, well, how many of you think that if there is a problem in the process, that the biggest problem is a lack of integrity? You know, it's fraud, waste, and abuse, and it's, you know, fraud. Anybody think that? Well, you guys are a lot smarter than I thought. Let me see. I thought you were attorney. I'm not an attorney, by the way, so I can say these bad things about attorneys. Well, how many of you would think that possibly one of the biggest problems, most costly problems, is the budgeting process, the lack of budget stability in the process? Anybody think that might be a problem in the process? Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm hoping I'm going to give you some perspective on that and those questions I asked you here by just running through a few points. Now, since I'm not sure how long it's going to take me to get through what I have to say, I'm going to tell you right up front what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to try to make three points today, and the first one is that from what I've seen, this is a pretty well-educated group here, so maybe you don't have the same perspective that a lot of the public does, but from what I've seen, a lot of the public think that there is problems in the process and that they're focused on lack of integrity and fairness in the federal acquisition process. But I believe that the real problems have more to do with the complicated processes and procedures that we have to deal with, and they're very difficult to articulate quickly. You can't put these things in sound bites. And so that's the first point. The second one is, I don't think the process is broken. It does need to be changed once in a while because the politics change, the economic environment change, the technology environment change. So all that, I think, does require change. And so we need to constantly keep it updated. And when we begin to make these changes, we debate them publicly. And, of course, different groups come at it from different angles, and sometimes we get into these discussions, and it begins to look like the process is broken to an outsider. And I think that's one of the things that happens. Now, the most significant point I want to make today is this, and that is that acquisition reform measures, when you're trying to fix these problems or you're trying to update the system, can result in very expensive unintended consequences. You have to be very careful when you're changing these complex processes. And one of the things that happens is sub-optimization occurs. In other words, you focus on a piece of the process and you try to make it perfect or close to perfect, and it screws up the rest of the process. And then you got to go back and fix the rest of it. So we get a lot of churning because of this sub-optimization. And if I have time at the end, I'll mention a few items that I think are going to be talked about, debated, dealt with on the Hill this year. But if I don't get to that part, the thing that I think is going to happen this year is going to be the year of Buy American. We're going to be talking about all the Buy American issues, so-called Berry Amendment that deals with buying certain specialty metals and textiles domestically. And we're going to be debating free trade versus protectionism, and participation in the global economy versus economic isolationism. And I suspect we got a few economists in here that are pretty well versed in that area. So I actually had some slides. I don't know who the slide person is, but if you want to put them up there, maybe it would be a little bit helpful. But I'll go on anyway so we don't run into any time crunch here. I'm sorry. Yeah, I do. I think there's only one thing on here, so. Okay. Overall, I think that the I personally think the federal acquisition process is well managed. I've been in it from both sides. I've been in it as a contracting officer in the military, both if you know about this, a procuring or buying person, and also a contract administrator, an ACO. And I've been in program management, and I've been in financial management. It is pretty well managed. It's not perfect, but it's pretty well managed. But there's a huge amount of money involved. And so any minor error or mistake that we make, in absolute terms, they're big dollars. And so while we need to focus on them, we can't lose sight of the fact that we do a pretty good job and we turn out pretty good products, the military does. With that in mind, if you get into the policy business and you begin to start thinking about how you'd make this process better, keep in mind that you don't need a new piece of legislation or a new regulation every time you run into a problem. A lot of times, problems that we discover can be fixed just by better implementation of what we got. And that's an important thing to keep in mind if you become a boss and you're in the policy business. The other thing that I would say, did this come on? Maybe. There you go. And how do we get to the second thing? I'm sorry, space? Okay, that's good. Okay. The the other thing is that acquisition and acquisition reform is a hot political target because everyone thinks they know how to fix the problem because everybody, of course, knows how to buy things, and you know they all buy them. So everybody's got an idea about it. But it's much more complicated than that because politics enters into it. And so problems that look fairly easy to a layman to solve get complicated by the complicated procedures and having to be involved in the political process. I'm sure you, in your jobs, you've got the same kind of situation. So what looks easy to fix often isn't. So in looking, you know, being critical of the process, okay, but remember when trying to fix it, to be careful. There have been probably three major reviews of the acquisition process, one of which I got to be on the staff of. It was headed up by David Packard, one of the founders of Hewlett-Packard. And On those looks at the acquisition process, there was a common theme that ran through all of them, and the theme was that the most costly problem is budget instability. And there's kind of a little axiom that says that if you increase the budget of a program, it's going to cost more per unit, and if you decrease it, it's going to cost more per unit. So budget instability just has a very insidious impact on costs. And so, but it's very difficult to keep the budget fixed because the political necessity and changes in financial needs. Okay, is the process broken? No, I don't think so. But it's an important question because that question is often used when the issues are debated in acquisition to maintain the status quo. I think you probably all heard this little saying that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, that's only a half truth. As I said earlier, the process may not be broken, but it needs to be kept up to date. And so you've got constant changes, and you have to be very careful not to churn the reform process too much, because you can have this sub-optimization which takes place. And whenever you're faced with making a change or improving the process, you need to make sure that you ask yourself, why hadn't this been done before? I mean, if it's such a great idea, we've been around for a couple hundred years, why haven't we done this before? Because a lot of the ideas, most of them, in fact, all the good and bad ideas, probably been presented before, and there's some reason why they're not being done. And sometimes it's a darn good reason. I'll give you one example to tell you what I'm talking about. Every once in a while in the Department of Defense, a new group comes in to manage it, and they propose using fixed price contracts to buy R&D. Now, I think you know that R&D is difficult to project how fast you can do it or how much it's going to cost. It, you know, somebody wants to develop what we say uses the common example, non-obtainium. And well, how are you going to know how long it's going to take you to get it or how much it's going to cost? So if you try to use a fixed price contract in it, you run into management problems, but you also run into terrible political problems because people expect you to develop non-obtainium in the budget and on the schedule that you've set forth, even though it's impossible. Nobody could do it. Nobody could guess it. You might do it sooner than you thought, or it might take you longer. And I can talk about this a little bit more if you have a question about it at the end and tell you why that's a problem. The fourth slide here is reform. Whenever we debate reform, almost never do you hear anybody saying that it's going to cost too much for reform. There's never an attempt to equate the benefit of the reform with the cost. And I can tell you that a lot of times the cost outweighs the benefit. We've done some studies. I was involved in a study and looking at not just reform, but the cost of oversighting and enforcing that. It's a big expense. And a lot of times we'll duplicate reforms. We'll have a problem, and we'll pass another law or another regulation and layer it on top, so we get multiple rules, and sometimes they conflict. So we have to be very careful when you're developing policy. Okay, so I got two more minutes. Sub-optimization, you got to be very careful about sub-optimization. This is the last point I'll make. I also ask myself why, after we debate a reform measure, and of course no reform measure is perfect, there's pros and cons to every one. We debate the pros and cons, and generally if the pros outweigh the cons, we'll implement it. Then you wonder, well, why later does it seem to fail and fall apart? Well, I think it's because we begin to sub-optimize. After the reforms passed, we get people coming in and taking a look at the con side of things, the faults of the thing, and they start focusing on those. And of course, it is a fault. We talked about it when we were debating the reform. And now you start trying to fix that. That con, and you sub-optimize in that you fix that one item, but you wreck the whole rest of the original reform. We've got one like that going on right now, and it has to do with commercial. We've decided that we're going to use commercial items because we save lots of money. We save money on R&D. We save money because we get further down the learning curve because we got all those commercial parts on top of military parts. And we also get the latest technology. But we've got the auditors going in and saying, well, you know, we're not able to audit those costs. We don't have audit rights. We don't have enough cost data. And they're asking for that. And that's not something that's common in the commercial market. And so what's happening is companies are starting to withhold their products off the market, not making them available to the military, and defeating the whole purpose for doing commercial. So we have to be so that was debated when we decided to do this. And unless we can, you know, come up with a really good reason why we should go back the old way and start paying for all the R&D and shorten up the learning curves and all that, I think we need to be careful about this suboptimization problem. Anyway, I hope that gives you a little bit of insight into what kind of problems are faced by the folks that have to deal with these kind of issues. And I think my fellow panelists here probably have something to say about what I had to say. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As the Cold War ran down, you're going to turn. Thank you. We began to pay attention to some of the threats to what was becoming called our infrastructure, and noticing that the government didn't run everything. It doesn't run, it regulates, but doesn't operate the banking system, the communication system. And as the year 2000 approached, and there was concern about perhaps terrorist attack during the millennium, we began to hear more and more about homeland security, and because that threat to homeland security was brought dramatically and tragically home to us on September 11, 2001. Larry Halloran is going to take this expanded view of our national security to include homeland security and bring that perspective to our deliberations.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As Professor Carroll said, there are persistent tensions in the federal contracting process between, from the old saying, you want it good, you want it fast. And that's security side, that dilemma plays out particularly these days because we have an adaptable foe, we have emerging threats, we have intelligence doesn't always pick them up very carefully, and we have a contracting process that then has to try to respond to that and acquire things. So I think in the national security realm, we can look at it in terms of new challenges meeting the old dilemmas of a contracting process that can look unwieldy and be made certainly like glaciers colliding, be made to look ugly and slow. But I think it was, as Mr. Marlowe said, it has its necessary dynamics and necessary evils. But I see six areas primarily where these challenges meet old tensions and old dilemmas in the national security realm that I want to talk about. The first, I mean, I think the tension is demonstrated by two things. There was a piece in yesterday's Washington Post, increase in contracting intelligence jobs raises concerns. And it talked about language skills, CIA analysts getting their clearances and getting out of the agency and then contracting those same skills back and areas that had not been contracted out before. And contrast that with the General Accounting Office, not the Government Accountability Office, ranking Department of Defense contract management as a high-risk undertaking of the government, posing a high risk of waste, fraud, abuse, and mismanagement. And I think they set a record for how long that particular function's been on the GAO high list series. So you have new challenges, old dilemmas, conflicting in the security realm and what we're trying to acquire to meet security needs. I think one of those first challenges would be, I think Professor Carroll mentioned as well, the presence of contractors deeper into the battle space than we've seen before. And that presents a variety of legal problems outside the contracting realm. Are they combatants? Are they non-combatants? Are they covered by Geneva Convention protocols? A whole other series of things. But on the purely contracting side, you have something called LOGCAP, the Army's Logistics Capacity Contract, that brings all the moving parts of that the Army used to bring with it. Now the contractors bring the food, the water, the sanitation, the housing elements. And that meets that new demand, that new kind of presence of contractors that far forward in the battle space, brings the old question to fore on what is an essential governmental function that only government should do, and what is a contractable or commercial item that we can bring with us in a kind of plug-and-play fashion. And that it's a moving line, but I think we've kind of lost sight of that debate. If we may have gone in some respects too far in the sense that if we can contract for it, we will. And that presents problems of its own. The second area is that we've begun contracting in the national security realm in the areas that were not formally thought of that way. I think the primary example would be Project BioShield, where we have Department of Homeland or Department of Health and Human Services, the Centers for Disease Control, National Institutes of Health, are suddenly in the national security contracting field, whereas they were not seen that way before. Health was health, national security was national security. But in BioShield, you have a proposition that we should be contracting for the research, the design, and the manufacture of biological countermeasures in the name of national security. But that's a whole realm where the even as flawed as you might view it, the whole DoD acquisition model doesn't really fit. There are many non-parallels to trying to build a vaccine as opposed to trying to build a jet. That acquisition model in BioShield 2 has what the contractors have come to call the valley of death between the design of the molecule, if you will, and the actual production of it for a market that everyone prays will never exist. And I think the administration is about ready to admit that in terms of BioShield, their acquisition strategy, if not flawed from the start, has not borne the fruit they'd hoped, that it was designed as though Big Pharma would step up like Lockheed builds jets, Big Pharma would step up and build vaccines for us. Again, you know, we build missiles, nuclear missiles, hoping not to use them, but we build them. Now we're supposed to make vaccines for a market we hope won't exist, but the model doesn't exist. Where to put them, who buys them, how to cost them. And between the design and the manufacture, there is this so far uncontracted for unfunded valley of death with a company, and I have lots come to my door to say, I got this grant, built this great molecule, and now I can't get it out the door. They won't fix a price to buy this many. They don't know how many they would need. And that I think, is the modern manifestation of the old dilemma of the federal government faces, of whether or not federal acquisition reflects the market or defines the market. And that's particularly true on the healthcare side, with Medicare and Medicaid trying to set prices for medical service in their 35 and 38 million patients respectively, penetrate the healthcare market so deeply. When they're told to go out and put their finger in the wind and test the market, well, they are the market, and they're reflecting themselves, and they are their own cause and effect, and the law requires them to reflect market prices, and which really can't be done. We haven't fixed that dilemma. National security these days, the acquisition also forces us to look what's called horizontally across government acquisition functions more than we did before. DOD buys certain things, Department of Transportation buys certain things, but in the realm of security, homeland security, national security, we need to think about what they're buying for each other. And I think the response to Katrina demonstrated that if DOT and the Coast Guard bring different radios to the scene of the natural disaster, and the locals have different radios still, we have a serious plug-and-play problem. And yet that kind of horizontal acquisition outside of some of the GSA schedules is something that we don't do very well at all, that we have left hands and right hands not shaking all over the place. And that, I think, reflects, as I said, the stovepipes that are present in federal procurement agency by agency, and law by law. Congress writes them that way and says you shall only do this as authorized and appropriated. So we're not without some blame in that. The other challenge, like in BioShield, but on the hard science side, is drawing out new technologies and knowing what you're doing. We have, last count, I think 13 different, utterly separate projects looking to design biological sensors. Three in the national labs, two elsewhere in the Department of Energy, six or seven in the Department of Defense last I looked. And I don't find any plan to figure out which one wins, or to pit two against each other, or to have a buy-off, or any kind of acquisition strategy to say this is what we're going to buy for that technology, which, by the way, is still at best second-generation technology. And what we buy, we should be very careful about buying, because it gives us, at best, a very indirect picture of what we have, what molecule we're sniffing out there. And we oughtn't to put too much faith in that. I mean, we are biological sensors. We're all canaries in the coal mine against the threat of biological terrorism. And the best sensor we have is the local emergency room. And it's the best we can do right now. The other challenge, as I said, is kind of new forms of contracting, not just where contractors are, but new things they're doing. There's a huge growth industry in personal security, personal protection, guys with guns, men and women with guns, excuse me. And I've been to Iraq four times since the major combat ended, and you see more and more USAID, State Department, all bring their own special forces, as it were. How we contract for those, it's an odd situation. That's unusual in my experience. We have an industry there that is asking for regulation, asking for standardization, because they've had some what they call blue-on-blue experiences, where they start shooting at each other because they don't know who they are, they don't know why they're there, they don't know what their terms of engagement are. And contract stipulations, contract terms, contract standard clauses can help fix that. But we asked DOD some time ago, who do you have out there besides the men, you know, the sworn men and women in the uniform that stick with you, who do you have that is authorized to shoot somebody over there? They didn't know. And the State Department didn't know who DOD had there, and vice versa. So that's a challenge, but it's a persistent challenge, again, and that has existed for some time in terms of contract provisions that meet the goal and not just buy the thing. The mix between products and services is something that contract managers don't always understand. And as oversight, we try to look and see, what are you buying? What does the contract say about when you will know if you're not getting it? What do you do about it? And that problem is coming home. There's a piece in the story in the newspaper last week. The city of New Orleans is thinking about hiring personal security contractors to walk the streets and act like police. Raises a host of fascinating legal issues in terms of who exercises the police power, whether you can contract it away. But that should be an interesting contract to read once they write it out. As was said also, the whole new emerging field is infrastructure protection. And the critical problem there is we don't know what's critical. If you ask a state, as DHS did, give us your list of critical infrastructure, you get back a shopping list of all the things they haven't fixed in the last 20 years. All the neglected maintenance is there. Yes, it's critical because it's breaking. It's not that the terrorist necessarily wants it, but we're terrorizing ourselves by letting it fall apart. We're sitting on a third world electrical grid that's likely to fall apart before Al-Qaeda ever gets to it. And so that decision, what's critical and how to protect it, and what measures you need to do that. And the mix between Gates, guns, and guards, and technology. We found that, particularly on the Department of Energy side, we've done a lot of work looking at the nuclear weapons complex. And post 9/11, the automatic instinct is to say, let's just put more bodies at the perimeter and we'll hold them off. But that gets expensive very quickly, and depending on what the intelligence community projects about the capabilities of those that might be coming at the perimeter of that facility, it's probably not enough. And so how you develop and acquire appropriate technology in some old facilities, increasingly close to residential areas, and then mix the human element with the technology is a serious both acquisition and contract management challenge. Finally, Iraq reconstruction has posed a number of profound contracting issues that I think we'll probably hear about in the next speaker as well. It's not just that we're buying things to use elsewhere, offshore, which is a different legal cat altogether. But in the case of Iraq, initially we were using other people's money to do it. We're using something called the Development Fund for Iraq, which was left over from the oil for food proceeds and some seized assets of the prior regime. And the contracts to perform initial reconstruction work using that money raise questions about Buy America. I mean, if we got soldiers there, shouldn't we give some preference to U.S. companies to do those things? The Iraqis had the same question. They wanted some of those contracts as well. But then that, as that played out, with the mix between appropriated money and other people's money, raised some serious questions in terms of, I think, first impression questions about how in this kind of international realm our contracting process works. Great case in point. We promised the United Nations that our spending of the Development Fund for Iraq would be transparent, that we would tell them how we gave the contracts, to whom, for how long, what was bought. But the Defense Department only sent the United Nations heavily redacted copies of the internal audits of those contracts. Why? Because the habit was that we would show them those contracts first to the contractor to take out proprietary information. Before we showed anybody, we couldn't publicly release that proprietary data. And we kind of let the contractors do that themselves. They took out everything meaningful. I mean, the UN got page numbers and page headings and not a lot in between. And that was not exactly the transparency we had promised. And so it was kind of two cultures meeting each other. It was a very serious problem. But it also pointed out the fact that overall, the process, to the extent it works, can be made to look very unpretty. And it's slow. The kinds of contracts dealing with there, what's called the definitization process, finally figuring out what was purchased, what was sold, and what was paid, and what the, owed the contractor, owed back from the contractor. It's slow. I mean, it's inevitable, and it happens. And you see now in the paper every day that Halliburton and company are either the Army is settling some of those contracts with them on the dollar or getting dollars back. But initially, you can call it payments, overcharges, overpayments, and make the process look pretty ugly. But it is a big and complicated process, and some understanding and patience is required. So to sum up, I think in the national security realm, what you're going to be seeing is increasingly cycles of immediate, responsive, kind of sole source contracts to get something out there now, because we didn't know what it was. We didn't know what the hurricane was coming at us. Some kind of multiple award IDIQ vehicles in between there to say we need to be able to task some things and keep it flexible, and then some sealed bid fixed price items to kind of finish it off. And I think that cycle will repeat itself. Because initially, Iraq, Katrina, initially you can say yes. Necessity being the mother of both invention and corruption in this case, we need to do something very quickly. But once the requirements are settled and we know what we're doing, we can finalize and open up that process more completely and then set it on some course to completion. Because even involving national security and those kinds of contingencies, the agency's lack of planning shouldn't be a perpetual problem, that you can see the requirement emerge over time. So I guess that's it. Thank you.
I'd like to take the historical perspective. When most of us from our reading of American history knew that George Washington had trouble with the states in funding the resources necessary just to raise troops and getting troops to stay in the army to fight. This is from the Continental Congress days. Less is known about how he got supplies and the logistics of it. Well, they used contractors, and they were out in the field with them, except they were called merchants then, and the merchants did everything because there just wasn't an infrastructure to handle that. And he had to deal with corruption and overpricing and mislabeled products, mostly horse thieves. During World War II, or at the end of World War II, Senator Harry Truman chaired a committee that looked deeply into what were excess war profiteering. And it was one of the features, the integrity with which he carried out that function, that made him attractive to Franklin Roosevelt when he was selecting from among candidates for vice president for his fourth term. So some of these problems of misconduct and corruption kind of are inevitable when you have large sums of money. Scott Amey is going to bring us a more up-to-date look at some of the modern instances of problems and perhaps a look at some of the reforms that are being considered by a congressional panel. Thank you.
That was a great intro, because mentioning the Truman Commission is something that's been kind of batted around here in Washington, D.C. since the beginning of the Iraq War. It's funny because when the Truman Commission actually returned $15 billion in $1940 back to the federal treasury. So if you can return $15 billion back in 1940, how much will we recover now? So it raises an interesting debate, but there are a lot of people in Washington, and this is the first actual major conflict we've ever been in where we don't have a Truman-like committee set up. So it's a question you may want to ask. As far as my bio is in your materials, the Project on Government Oversight, some of the people that have been in Washington for a while may know us as the Project on Military Procurement. In the 80s, we were the organization that exposed the $7,000 coffee pot and the $432 hammer. But one of the things that I want to first go through is kind of the changes that we've seen since the $400 hammer and why oversight and transparency and accountability is an important and just aspect of the contracting system that we're really lacking currently. The biggest change is services have taken over. Now, majority of the federal money spent is in services. In fiscal year 2002, we had just under 1 billion actions for the procurement community. That equated to $218 billion. For fiscal year 2004, and this is using GSA's own numbers right off its website, we had 10.5 billion actions, so we're up 700,000 there, and we've also gone up near $350 billion. So that's nearly $130 billion increase just in a matter of five fiscal years. What is that attributed to? That's post 9/11. That's also outsourcing. Some of the initiatives that the other panelists have spoken about are a reason why these numbers are increasing. The major concern, however, with that is while you've had money go dramatically through the roof, you've also had huge cuts in acquisition workforce. So you have fewer people spending more money. The problem that creates is that a lot of any oversight that they have is usually front-loaded on the spending side. There is very little, and we see dwindling oversight on the backside as far as administration and oversights of contracts once they're awarded. And that's what you're starting to see now post-Katrina with GAO reports that are coming out. It's also what we're seeing with Iraq reconstruction. With that being said, the Department of Transportation, and the GSA only had two numbers for this, but in, I guess it was about fiscal year 2003, they were about $5.6 billion. Fiscal year 2004, they're up over $6 billion. So again, you have over nearly half a billion dollar increase just in the Department of Homeland Security's money. And again, you have fewer people overseeing that. One of the problems that we've seen is cutbacks in the acquisition workforce, but one of the scarier considerations here is the fact that there are so many baby boomers that are out there that I've seen numbers anywhere from 30% to 50% of acquisition workforce is set to retire in the next 5 years. So this is going to be a much larger problem that we have with, you're going to lose a lot of institutional memory, you lose a lot of experience, training, and that can't be replaced overnight. No matter how much training you put someone through, if you lose a contracting officer, a market researcher with 20, 30 years of experience, you're never going to replace that. No offense by anybody graduating here in the next few years, and then any of the students, but that's not going to be easily replaced. So it is a major concern that we have. A lot of these contracting reforms and some of the things that we're seeing here and a lot of the scandals, a lot of people want to point a finger at the Bush administration. You know, this needs to go back multiple administrations. This is Clinton Gore. This is reinventing government, streamlining government. Everybody may remember Al Gore sitting on David Letterman and smashing a hammer into an ashtray because in the contract it required it couldn't break into so many pieces and there were all kinds of requirements for government ashtrays. That's the initiative that this was all born out of. And it was an effort to make the government run more efficiently, cut red tape. Mr. Marlowe, I'm sure, is familiar with a lot of this because I know his association and some of the multi-group associations were promoting these initiatives. At POGO, we just considered them, they were very contractor-friendly. getting a lot of red tape. You also cut back on acquisition workforce. You cut back on audits. You cut back on oversight. And that's, you know, some of the problems that we're starting to see now. And like I said, there has been more emphasis on awarding contracts and not as much emphasis on monitoring contracts. And that's kind of where we stand. With that being said, one of the things that in the Clinton-Gore initiative and what we're seeing now is to make the government run more like a business. Let's make it more commercial. The commercial market works. It works for GE. It works for Boeing. It works for Lockheed. It works for Sony. Why can't the government operate the same way? There is some truth to that, and I do agree with Mr. Marlowe on many things, but one of the ones is the system is very complex, and that slows the system down. But the problem and the difference in the commercial market and in the government is taxpayers. GE can decide not to give big, huge bonuses. GE can decide not to give money to its shareholders. Those decisions can be made. With the taxpayers' money, it's a lot different scenario, and it's something that we always have to keep in mind. You don't want to reduce innovation, but you also don't want to increase the risk on the taxpayer either. Also, one of the other issues is the consolidation in the industry. The government now relies on fewer contractors. There's not as many people out there that provide goods and services to the federal government as there once were. A lot of this we saw in the 80s and in the 90s when you went down from hundreds of defense contractors down to a small few. The government has fewer places to turn. So you talk about innovation on one side and risk, but on the other side, you have to realize that you're probably going to be working with the same contractors on a continual basis, and so at that point, the industry has really stifled itself, which is part of the market economy. People have come and gone, businesses have merged, subsidiaries, you know, all the different terms that you hear with, you know, economics, but it's also caused a problem with the government because we have fewer places to buy from, and that's a trouble when you're spending money and you're the largest consumer in the world, which the federal government is. One of the things that I really want to get to are the concerns and the vulnerabilities that we have. We've seen it in Katrina, we've seen it in Iraq, the war on terrorism just overall. But these are bigger than just national security. These are just huge vulnerabilities that we have overall in the way the federal government spends our money. And there are things that I think the federal government needs to look at. I'm not pushing for an all new acquisition reform for new laws, but I think there is some tweaking that needs to be done to the system to get it to run more efficiently and effectively. The first thing is negotiations. The federal government has to enter just aggressive negotiations. The contractors will always argue that, you know, we're on the same team here, but whenever I've gone to purchase a car, I've never been really on the same team as the person trying to sell it to me. I want free floor mats. I want the CD player, and I don't want to have to pay for it. I want undercoating, whatever the heck that is. And that person's trying to make a dollar for himself or herself and also for the dealer. So at that point, you know, there is just a buyer-seller relationship that you have there that necessarily isn't arm-in-arm as much as the government has kind of evolved into. Competition. One of the biggest things here is that we have to just evaluate goods and services. Like I've already said, we've had consolidation in the industry, and that has fewer places where the government can turn. But the government and the private sector, I've sat in a lot of panel meetings. If you're not familiar with it, it may be something you want to look into. It's called the 1423 panel. It's also the Acquisition Advisory Panel. It came out of legislation back in, I think, 2002, 2003, where it's a panel of industry representatives, government representatives, and even some professors who are taking a look at the way the government buys services. And they're raising some actually interesting questions on, have we gone too far to the commercial mode of buying that isn't working efficiently for the federal government? They have their own website. You can, if you just do, 1423 panel, you'll find them. If not, you can go to POGO's website. We have a link to it there. And one of the things that they're trying to determine is, have we gone too far? And with this, that's part of it, is competition. Everyone that I've seen, and I've seen major corporations come in there and testify, and they say, well, as a buyer, when we're buying from a vendor, we need as much competition as possible to make sure that we get the best price. But when you hear those people selling to the federal government, it's kind of a, I don't know if they go as far as to say they want as much competition. I've actually seen literature in which they say, competition is a plague, and you don't want competition, and you want the no-bid contract, and that makes the system run more efficiently and effectively. But when they're buying, it's kind of the opposite side of the coin. Accountability. The biggest thing here is to ensure taxpayers are spent wisely. We need to get in there and audit numbers. I agree with Mr. Marlowe, in some circumstances, when you're buying commercial off-the-shelf items, That is true. If you can go in and buy Staples, or you can buy an airplane that is on the commercial market that United or U.S. Airways buys, that's fine. But the problem with this is there are certain things that the government does where they need a commercial-like item. So it's not exactly commercial. There's real no commercial market for it. But what is the government going to do? Are we going to buy it at the commercial price or not? And then should we have the ability to go in and see what that so-called commercial-like item is selling for to be able to determine whether the taxpayer got a fair and reasonable price? We've gone pretty far over to the commercial mode, and I'm not sure that's necessarily the best way to go when you're spending taxpayer dollars. Transparency. One of the biggest things that we've gotten away with, and I forget who mentioned it, I think it was Mr. Halloran, but we mentioned, you know, having contractors go in and redact information that was that they want to supply to the UN. Well, that's frightening. That dates back to Ronald Reagan, and I think it was kind of a gift that he gave the contractors back in the day. Now it's actually an exemption from FOIA. I struggle with this every day because I have the FOIA documents to receive these contracts in. I hope that the government isn't rubber stamping what the contractors feel should be pulled out of contracts. Transparency, in the old days they used to say sunlight is the best disinfectant. If we get to see these contracts, if we get to see the items, the item lines and the costs and prices for those items, that will, I think, will restore a lot of integrity into the system that currently is in the dark and that we don't get to see, and that's a true problem. A lot of, I think, the concerns that I have and the vulnerabilities are based on the fact that we're not seeing everything. And I realize that you need to protect some of the information because you don't want to blow out a contractor and have their competitor see everything, but at the same time, the taxpayer deserves, you know, some to see some of that information. Contracting vehicles. One of the biggest things with reforms through the years has been we've adopted a lot of the contracting vehicles that have been used in the commercial market. And the problem that you have there is the government has kind of used them and not sure how to use them, has forced them and had quotas on forcing government agencies to use them. Some of them work, and I can go through some of them with performance-based contracts, interagency contracts, time and material contracts. That's one that we just saw. If anybody's been following MZM in the recent articles in the Washington Post, the government was giving a time and material contract. That term may not be on the tip of everyone's tongue here, but anytime you take your car in to have it fixed, they give you back, here's what it's, you know, new muffler costs this, so that's the material, and my time to install for you is an hour and a half. So at that point, here's what it's going to cost you. This is something that we work with in the commercial market all the time. The question, though, for the government is there's no guarantee that you're going to get a product or of 100% of a service back. A lot of those contracts are just somewhat open-ended, and you have a problem with, well, what am I going to get at the end of that contract? You're going to bill me for a lot of time and a lot of material, but at the end, how's that going to affect me, and what am I going to get back as an end result? Scary concept. It does work. There are certain instances where it works. Lawnmower services, something like that, where you're working for the government. But do you really want, somebody working on airplanes or something, you know, something that's a little more complex to be used in that sense? Just one point that I wanted to go back to because I was looking at your itinerary of some of the speakers that you had had come in already, and I want to get back to the transparency issue. Was I think you had a speaker who was general counsel of the 9/11 Commission, something like that. One of the things, if you read that report, is, and they document it multiple times, how many times that classified documents really inhibited what they were supposed to be doing. They even, you know, had classifications, but, and I think it was the chair of the 9/11 Commission came out and said he was just amazed at how much information had been classified. Since 9/11, we've seen kind of a hybrid in between full and open and available to the public and classifications with, it's called SBU, sensitive but unclassified. We've seen a lot more information that was once publicly available is now taken out of the public light. The problem with that is obviously then we're not seeing whether it's contracts, critical infrastructure, and it's caused a real problem. I know I have a problem with it a lot now because the agencies don't have a blanket regulation on this. Different agencies have different standards, but it's really creating a problem, and it's creating a problem in the watchdog community and for the public because you have, for example, DHS actually had a non-disclosure agreement that they were making all their employees, contractors, and consultants sign. POGO actually was fighting against this. Eventually they cut it back and said, well, employees don't have to sign this. Well, if you look at their for official use only policy, which usually doesn't carry any weight here in Washington, D.C., if something's stamped for official use only, DHS was expanding that policy that you couldn't talk about the document, although it was subject to FOIA. And I said, as a watchdog and somebody that sends in FOIAs, well, how am I going to learn about it if no one's allowed to talk about it? So it was truly throwing a blanket of secrecy over anyone that had signed this policy, and also anybody that was handling for official use only information. One of the intriguing parts of that policy was the fact that it said, if this is not stamped for official use only, but you think it should be, you have to protect it as well. Again, that how do you, as an employee, and you risked administration, prosecution, criminal, civil liability for this if you sign the non-disclosure agreement, that at that point, who is going to be the one that's going to talk about something or provide it to the public if you could risk losing your job? So they're the kind of things that you really want to think about, and that's where SBU comes in. One of the last things I wanted to say is that this is very interesting. I'm like surprised at how few people raised their hand when Mr. Carroll mentioned waste, fraud, and abuse, or Mr. Marlowe, because like recently we've seen a lot of scandals in Washington, D.C. We've had Darlene Druyan, Boeing stealing proprietary documents from its own competitor to receive a contract, David Safavian, who was a head honcho over at GSA, Duke Cunningham, MZM, Abramoff, Iraq bribery scandals involving contractors and also even our own military. Custer Battles, just in the past 2 or 3 weeks, had a $10 million fine imposed by it, against it by a jury in Washington, D.C., or in Northern Virginia. The Department of Justice didn't sign on to that case. It was a False Claims Act case. And Mr. Carroll's kind of historical perspective here is interesting because the False Claims Act actually goes back to the Civil War and was called the Lincoln Law because Abraham Lincoln passed it to make sure that we weren't buying shoddy equipment and military equipment from the Union states. But Custer Battles ended up having to pay, will have to pay $10 million in a fine for defrauding the government in $3 million. We've also seen auditors with Halliburton that have come back and said that the auditors have found, and at one point it was up nearly $2 billion, but I think it's been reduced to a few hundred million. Federal auditors weren't able to find that money, and somebody mentioned, the term was. But it is a complicated process. But one of the things that I go back to is tax time's coming up. If I can't justify my full tax return to the federal government, I'm in big trouble. More than likely, I'm going to jail. And at some point here, we have to hold our contractors in that community accountable, whether it's to a same standard or just something less. But at some point, we have to hold them accountable. The GAO just came out with a report in the last week that looked at Katrina contracting. There were multiple aspects. One was communications, but the first was poor planning. FEMA was really stuck with it on its back heels and with its feet stuck in the mud, and they really didn't meet its mission. That's a major issue, and I think all federal government agencies have to go back and review that. But another part of that report was paying inflated prices. This isn't something new. A lot of these laws, the regulations go back a long time. A lot of the reforms that have been passed have been in the works and on the books for 10 years. But it's a matter of getting it right, and that's where providing oversight, transparency, accountability, better competition will allow us to do that. Thank you.
This line of sight, I'm not able to see over here, so I'm going to take the podium again. As I said before, we'd welcome questions that will expand upon some of the points that were made, or if you would like to ask the panelists something that we didn't cover. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My gratitude to all of you for participating in the panel. Mr. Halloran, if I may ask you, you mentioned BioShield specifically. Would you be able to discuss a little bit of the history of, I understand, obviously the program was started in Homeland Security, established, and then it was passed back, HHS, et cetera. Could you discuss some of the legislative history and specifically the legislative intent with respect to various aspects of BioShield, and specifically the Special Reserve Fund?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a large part of the BioShield Act is procurement oriented in terms of the expedited and authorities and easier methods to contract and acquire for biological countermeasures. The intent was to stimulate and facilitate the development of biological countermeasures to put in the national stockpile. As I said before, the intent was, the hope was that it would bring forward as kind of a macro response that the large, big pharma would that had its own internal R&D and the ability to traverse what they now call the valley of death from development of the molecule to a production process to FDA approval to actual production would be internalized someplace else. But now HHS finds itself, in their own words, kind of stuck with smaller entities that only have one or more, two pieces of that six or seven piece process. And traversing to the end when you actually get a product in the stockpile is something they've not quite managed to do yet. The intent, I'll tell you, was there. It was also to focus BioShield on the threat list. I mean, it's anthrax, botulinum toxin, ricin are the top three on anybody's list. And yet, between NIH and DOD had several projects going as well as developed biological countermeasures against plague and some equine viruses and things that the Army came across in different parts of the world, that now we just kind of take whatever comes over the transom and say, oh, I got a great treatment for this, a great vaccine for this item that happens to be number 11 on the threat list, and we throw some money at it. And that wasn't the intent at all, but that's in terms of trying to develop some momentum for a project, that's what's been happening. The reserve fund, I haven't looked at it lately. I'm not sure what the function is or the problem is. But it's, again, it's not bridging that gap between development, conceptual development, and even designing manufacturing process and getting to an FDA-approved process. It was meant to do that, but nobody's there yet. Nobody's applying for it. It has yet to work that way to facilitate that.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I'm Ed Spanis from Executive Intelligence Review. I'd like to raise the question that was Terry Halloran alluded to in a Washington Post article yesterday about the outsourcing of intelligence and what the, from the standpoint of the national security implications, not so much questions of corruption and so forth, but I mean, this has already been a big issue with logistics outsourcing, that the military is losing capabilities that it needs to have when you're not losing capabilities, but you're even losing the next generation, because the people that go into the contracting are the people who've been trained by the military. You're no longer training the people in the military to do it. Where do you get the next generation of this? But I mean, more seriously, is if you had to fight a real war, I mean, against an adversary that had a real army, a navy, and air force, unlike what we're doing right now, you couldn't operate this way, obviously, contracting all this stuff. You have to have those logistics capabilities within the military. And I think the same thing is true of intelligence, that with the contracting more and more of this out, you're also losing capabilities that you need to have within the government agencies, military or intelligence agencies. So could one or all of you address that?
Good. One of the interesting things is that in 2002 or 2003, they kind of watered down what was considered an inherently governmental function. And I think Congress is going to have to revisit that definition. I think at that point they inserted the word substantially. I think it was maybe, you know, a one-word change to the legislation in which, you know, what at one time had to be performed by a career civil servant is now, because they've inserted substantially, now has kind of raised the bar on what is considered to be, you know, what is the government has to keep in-house versus what it can send out. You raised some great points, and I think we need to revisit that definition, because it is, in watering it down, we've actually just opened the government, and I would say, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, to everything be outsourced. We've seen it with Booz Allen writing the defense budget. That is one issue where I would think that that would be something that you'd want to do in-house and would be a budgetary issue, but they've actually outsourced that function to a contractor, that we need to revisit the definition. We need to revisit what we want in-house. That POGO had actually submitted FOIA requests for all the government inventories of what can be outsourced, what's in a gray area, or what can be what has to remain inside the government. You would think that that would be an easy process, and I would have just gotten a list. Instead, I received disks of information all coded where I have to go figure it out by everybody's job, activities code, and everything else. It's a huge task. I know there are a bunch of people in Washington, D.C., especially from the Maryland, from Maryland, that are interested in it, but it's going to have to be revisited sooner than later.
Anyone else?
I think there's – I want to make a distinction, though, between the DOD part, which I agree with, that there are certain – logistics is a great example – things that we need to be able to do inherently to bring with us to a fight in order to function effectively. And I think we've cut a little deep in that in terms of what we take to war with us. On the intelligence side, I'm not quite so sure. I think at least during this transition period when we need to figure out what in the world modern intelligence is, we still have billion-dollar satellites looking down at Russian missile silos where the terrorists aren't. And so I think until we figure out what our intelligence requirements are, we ought not to be trying to define what essential governmental functions are in that realm and hire people to do that, because it's a great saying of the Pentagon, and elsewhere I'm sure you've heard it, that if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if all you've got is people who do this, that's what they're going to do. And we're not quite ready to decide that in the intelligence community yet, I don't think. So I would caution a little bit about being too premature in fixing that concept.
Did you add anything?
Well, I think
you can follow up.
Just briefly, and again, it's a question of, I think, a budget in dollars. And what's the answer to keeping it in house? Oftentimes, it's more money. And so, if we're willing to spend more money, then maybe that's a good idea. But I think people are trying to do this work for less money. But I agree, you have to be cautious about what you contract. I was surprised one time to find out that in the active military, there are no cartographers anymore. They're all in the reserves, or in the National Guard or someplace. Pretty interesting. I didn't know that.
And I think that's, in the short term, it may look like it's saving money, but I think in the long term, we'll find out it doesn't. The other question on the intelligence functions, it is a little different, because that also goes back to the previous panel. You have a question there of when you're contracting out, as the CETA thinks, domestic surveillance way beyond what its charter here. And I think this Able Danger program operated the same way, where you had data mining being done by private contractors being fed into government agencies. You also there lose your degree of oversight, the ability of private individuals or organizations to FOIA this information is no longer there when it's with contractors. So there's a lot of different kind of shell games going on around this stuff. But when you're dealing with intelligence, you're also putting things beyond the realm of your oversight committee and public.
I agree. And that's been a frustration for us, as has been the proliferation of SBU markings. And putting something beyond the contracting wall makes it an additional barrier we have to try to pierce to get through to see what the government's actually doing or buying. But again, all I can say is that those are second-level questions. I'm not sure we've solved the first level yet, what our intelligence requirements are. Open-source data mining, we're doing it on the health side. We're doing something called syndromic surveillance, where we look at emergency room orders and HMO, nurse call-in lines, and information to look for sentinel information about outbreaks. That's domestic intelligence. It's not names attached to it necessarily, but we contract that out. So I think we need to decide what our intelligence needs are and then decide what essentially has to be handled inside and what we might be able to contract out. We're not there yet.
I think before we break, Terry, you had mentioned that if there was time, you could talk about some of the legislation that's likely to be debated this year.
Yeah, I guess you might want to hear about that. I just wrote down a couple things that... What was I going to say? I'm sure I mentioned
it. Well, you emphasized Buy American as a...
Let me see what I've got. Oh, here we go. I think you're going to see an increased use of performance-based contracting. It's a great technique. The technique first came to my attention when I first went in the Air Force back in 1969, and we used to buy tires, aircraft tires, using a military specification, and we told them how much rubber and how long to cook it and all that kind of thing. And then somebody got the bright idea. Sometimes you couldn't tell really whether the guy had done a good job of making the tire. Some of the tires you could make, you know, 1,000 landings or 100 landings, whatever, and buy another tire using the same specification, be a different number of landings. So somebody figured out, well, let's buy the tires by the number of landings, the number of performances. And so now we had a way, a good way to compare different proposals. We did the same thing with brakes, you know, how many landings can you make with a brake, rather than a military specification. So I think you're going to see more of that. I think we're going to see some focus on improving incentive contracting. There's some questions about use of something called award fee, which you read in the paper, everybody calls it a bonus. It is not used as a bonus today. It started out that way, but it now is the entire incentive. And what some people are pushing for is to reduce that. And we are down at a point where we have to be careful because you won't get anybody, well, you'll get somebody, but you won't get the kind of people bidding on those contracts. You're not careful about how you use that. And I think what you're going to see is we're back to normal incentives with adding an award fee onto it. And the award fee is very flexible, allows program manager to manage his programs better. So I think we'll see more of that. I think you're going to see more emphasis on the use of commercial products, mainly because there's a tremendous amount of cost savings involved in that. You're going to see some talk about stable program funding account, which is kind of a managed reserve. I don't think it's ever going to happen, but we're going to talk about it a lot. It's a way of stabilizing the budgets, which is the big problem I was talking about that costs the most money. We're going to see a rebuilding of the acquisition workforce. I think there's going to be a lot of focus on that. I don't know if it'll get bigger, but I think we're going to focus a lot on training. And when you do have training, people have to be taken out of the system and put in schools, so you're going to have to get some more people to get trained. And we're going to focus on making sure they get the right experience. I think that's going to be an issue this year. And then I think something that we're going to see a lot of this year, and we've done a study of this. It's not an easy problem to fix. But there are a lot of barriers to people serving in the government, particularly if they come out of major jobs in industry. There are a lot of things that prevent them from serving. And we've got a report that we've just done. We're going to release it at the end of the month. And I think you'll see a lot of discussion about how do we change the process of vetting these people ahead of time, making sure we got people who can pass all the milestones to serve in the government, and making those milestones realistic and make sure we only got the necessary ones, and then going through the entire Senate confirmation process. That's what I see this next year.
Well, I think there's another panel due up in 15 minutes. Is that correct? So it's time for a break. And on behalf of the panel, thank you all for your attention after lunch. We appreciate it. Thank you.